Welcome to Bishop Sheridan Presents on the Catholic Radio Network. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a weekly roundtable discussion of events and issues facing the church and culture today. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a production of the Diocese of Colorado Springs and the Catholic Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Bishop Michael Sheridan of the Diocese of Colorado Springs.
Welcome, everyone. This is Bishop Michael Sheridan. Our guest today is Mike Calicrate. Mike's a rancher and a business entrepreneur, and he owns Calicrate Beef Company and Ranch Foods Direct Store. But I don't think he's here really to talk about those as much as he is just to talk about farming and to talk a bit about a theme that is important to him, that eating is a moral act. That is a very curious thing to say. Mike, welcome. Thank you for being here. And why don't you spend a few minutes introducing yourself to our listeners and a little bit about your background.
Thank you, Bishop. I really appreciate this opportunity today. I grew up in Evergreen, Colorado, on a small acreage, 5 acres up there. My father was a farmer as a child growing up, and left the farm to do other kinds of work, like build things. He was a millwright, was involved in the Eisenhower Tunnel and the big power plant north of Denver. But he always had agriculture around our family. There was 8 children in our family. We always had chickens. We had other livestock. We grew gardens. To a large extent, fed ourselves as a family growing up there in Evergreen, Colorado. And so when I left high school, I was interested in agriculture. And sort of what led me to that is an odd choice, perhaps, for some. But I was very interested in rodeo. I was a bull rider.
Oh, really?
In fact, I was a professional bull rider for 10 years as I worked my way through college. And on into what I do today. So as a bull rider, I ended up in college at Lamar Community College in Lamar, Colorado. And I met a guy there by the name of Red Heath, who was the animal science professor. And he recruited me into his animal science class from the bull riding and the rodeo team.
And what is animal science, Mike?
Well, it used to be called animal husbandry. And it's really all about the care of cattle, pigs, sheep, chickens, whatever. It's about livestock raising. And it's interesting because it used to be called animal husbandry.
Right. No, I've heard
and,
that.
And doesn't that sound good? That sounds good. And now we're going to call it, since those 70s or late 60s, early 70s, we decide in the land-grant colleges that teach it to call it animal science. And so you can feel a kind of sense what's happening here. We're going from husbandry to science, which might exclude some of the things that I think are important today after living through this transition of agriculture from family farming, where animals were very important on farms and ranches across the country. To where now animals really aren't that important. They're just something to produce more in a factory kind of a type operation. Instead of the family farm with the kids all working and, you know, producing some hogs and some chickens and some cattle and producing the crops with the manure of those livestock going on the land to improve its fertility and all of this in sort of a sustainable kind of a thing. We are now talking about animal science, and so this was my introduction really into the land grant college kind of an approach to producing food. And so I met Red Heath down there. He got me very interested in livestock production, and put me on his judging team. We traveled all over the country. We saw a lot of things, and I ended up marrying a girl that I met that was a rodeo person. A barrel racer, and I ended up going home with her to St. Francis, Kansas, where my cattle operation is now. And it was because of her and her family being from there that I ended up there. And so after I got to St. Francis, there really wasn't room on the farm for me. So I started another cattle operation. It was a feedlot. And I built a feed yard, about a 14,000-head feed yard there in the community with nine other producers and shareholders. Some of them, in fact, were tractor implement dealers. There was two veterinarians. A lot of them were farmers and livestock producers. And so that went well. That was the first one in Northwest Kansas, the first feeding operation, utilized a lot of the feed and grain around our community. So it had a really positive economic impact.
I'm a city boy. You're going to probably have to do some explaining to me. Tell me again, what did you call it, a feedlot?
It's a feedlot. And basically what it is it's a place where you put cattle to finish them for the marketplace. So cattle are raised on grass.
Right.
Cows raise calves. They're out there for 6 months. The cow has the calf, like right now, during this time of year, we're calving very heavily. And so, you know, we talk about how a cow eats grass and that grass becomes a calf and all of a sudden it's worth money. In fact, it's nourishing your body. It's food on your plate. And so it's like Ben Franklin said. He said a farmer is a wealth creator, basically. And he really honored the farmer, Ben Franklin. And he said, you know, a farmer puts a seed in the ground. He puts a seed with soil, adds water and sunshine, and as if by magic, wealth is created. And this is what farmers and ranchers do, is they create this wealth that's so critical to the very foundation of our economy.
So this is something you started in Kansas.
Exactly. I started it in Kansas. We already produced the cattle in the area, but we didn't have anywhere to finish them to make them ready for the marketplace. It's that last 120 or 180 days that those animals
you
after
have to feed them differently. Is that it?
Or well, you feed them is the point. You know, we have a 120 day growing season basically in Kansas. It's shorter here because we're at a higher elevation in Colorado Springs. But after that calf is weaned from its mother in the fall, the freeze is hit. Everything is dying or is dead. And so the nutrient value of the grass goes way down, and you need to supplement the animals. You need to feed them to get them through the winter, through the snow months and cold time of the year. So it makes sense then to bring the calf in from its mother and place it in a pen, and you feed that animal. And we feed them all natural, good, healthy ingredients like hay and grain and supplements to balance their diets to where they are gaining good weight. And in fact, it brings up the thought, when you talk about feedlots, I sort of helped make that a bad name, a bad word. I helped Michael Pollan with his book Omnivore's Dilemma. I helped Eric Schlosser with Fast Food Nation. I was in the credits of Food Incorporated.
Really?
and Fresh. And,
yeah.
And so I've done a lot of work, you know, trying to bring awareness around our food system. And so I helped Michael Pollan really make corn bad. It's not that corn is bad. It's that we use so much corn in this industrial model of cattle production that it has become bad. We subsidize this cheap corn, and this cheap corn ends up in almost everything we eat in a grocery store, from high fructose corn syrup to many, many other things. And in particular, it's fed to livestock. And so that's where the feedlot kind of got a bad name. Again, it's not.
But it doesn't have to have it bad corn.
Feedlots aren't bad.
Yeah.
Now, when you get into a feedlot like the one in Yuma, Colorado, the biggest feedlot in the world, it's 130,000 head of cattle in one place. That's too many. That's too many to be sustainable. That's too many to supply the feed and everything those animals need in the area, and at the same time get rid of the manure, which is a gift. The manure is a wonderful thing. But like a lot of things, too much of it is not a wonderful thing. Too much of it in one place is not a wonderful thing. So I was a cattle feeder. I'd graduated from Colorado State University with an animal science degree, finished up there, and ended up going back to St. Francis and building this feedlot, 14,000-head feedlot, which is actually pretty small compared to the big corporate feed yards that we see today. And so I had fun doing that. And I operated that operation for about 8 years, and then I got out and I got on my own, and this is the operation I have today. It's a smaller operation. We still feed our cattle, but we do it much differently. I had an awakening back in about 1988 to 1990 about this food system and what it had evolved into, from the family farm type operation to the big mega farm, to the big industrial kind of approach to food production. And this was the policy that was adopted by our government back in probably the late 50s. And back then, they had a policy in place. In fact, it's in writing. You can read about it. And basically, the thought was, we've just come out of the war. We've got all of this industrial production, which has been highly beneficial to the economy, people making things and producing wealth. And we need to expand that. We need to export more, and we need to expand it. But what we need is labor to get it done. And we feel in America that we have this excess human resource on the farms across America. And if there's a way that we could move this excess human resource from the farms of America to the cities and put them to, I'm going to quote, more productive work, this would be beneficial for America. And this is exactly what happened. So we had the biggest corporations of America getting together with political leadership of America, and they implemented this policy that would...
And this was simply to be able to produce more, right?
It was to produce more with cheaper labor.
Okay.
Because the farm labor was highly, just had a lot of work ethic. They were highly skilled in many, many ways. I mean, you run into a farmer, they can fix anything, they can build stuff, they can grow things, they know how to do so many things. And they were making absolutely the best workers that any manufacturer could imagine. And so they needed policy that would move these people from the farms into the city. So we started the Green Revolution. And it talked about chemical fertilizers and chemical pesticides and bigger tractors with bigger machinery. And basically, it also included bigger buyers of what farmers produced. In fact, so big that we now have four big meat packers in our country today that control over 80% of the entire steer and heifer market. And these big packers have decided to cooperate rather than compete. And this is much of what I work on today, is trying to restore competition to the marketplace and get a more fair value for what producers produce back to those farm and ranch gates. And I would like to see us reverse that whole flow of people again from the city back to these rural communities. And all it's going to take is a way for them to make a living in these rural communities, because they're wonderful places to live. But there's no realistic way to move to a rural community today and make a living, because farm gate income as a percent of what consumers pay for food has never been lower in our history. And so I work every day to try to restore income at the farm and ranch gate, rebuild rural communities back to sustainability again, and at the same time provide consumers, eaters, with the very best possible food that we can produce.
Mike, aren't there going to be people, though, let me just play devil's advocate for a minute, aren't there going to be people who say, this is the 21st century, you know, this is not the 19th or the 18th century when, you know, these farms spotted, you know, the entire, most of the country anyway. Why shouldn't we be doing things more efficiently? And aren't you just being a little romantic about this, Mike? You understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I deal with it all the time. Absolutely. Yeah. I completely understand. You know, this idea of efficiency and economy of scale has legitimized much of the consolidation and concentration that we have seen in not only agriculture, but in our financial markets, in our manufacturing. Barry C. Lynn wrote a great book. I just got it last summer. He was a speaker at the Organization for Competitive Markets annual meeting. He wrote the book called Cornered: Monopoly Capitalism and the effects of companies being too highly concentrated, and what effect that has on the economy, what effect it has on wages, what effect it has on family life, community life, and so forth. One of the things that they all claim as they merge, as they buy each other out and become more concentrated, is this economy of scale and efficiency argument. And nowhere in any of our antitrust laws, and nowhere in our history does any of our laws say that a company has to become more efficient, and they have to have the economies of scale.
Mike, could we pause there for just a minute? We need to take a little break, and we're going to pick right up on that idea when we come back.
Hi, this is Bill Howard, editor of the Colorado Catholic Herald. Did you know that some of the stories and news briefs that appear in every issue of the Colorado Catholic Herald are pitched by you, our readers and listeners? Help us highlight the good news at your parish for the larger diocesan community by contacting us at 719-866-6492 or by sending an email to editor@coloradocatholicherald.com. And we encourage you to register at your parish if you haven't already done so, because one of the benefits of registering at the parish is that you get the Colorado Catholic Herald for free in your mailbox. Thanks for your readership. And now we return to another very special episode of Bishop Sheridan Presents.
Welcome back. I'm visiting with Mike Calicrate of Calicrate Beef Company. And we're not so much doing a commercial for Calicrate Beef Company as listening to Mike talk about something that he has a great passion for, bemoaning first the disappearance of the family farm that was so prevalent, I guess, up until World War II, Mike? Or?
Well, the family farm really suffered its decline, significant decline after the 50s, after the World War, after World War II. And like we said, we moved this valuable human resource to what they call more productive work in the factories of America. And these were not willing departures from the farm. And part of the policy to move these farmers off the land was to reduce their income. And so there was policies drafted in our government that would lower the income of a farmer, that he would receive less for a bushel of wheat, less for a bushel of corn, less for a head of livestock, and the farm wouldn't support the family anymore.
And this is competition. In other words, because all of this went, as you said, to the city, became big business, the small farmer couldn't compete?
Well, the small farmer couldn't make a living.
That's what I meant.
And it really wasn't even a matter of competing, because he really wasn't competing against anything, because they were still the producers of food. In our country, they just received so much less of what consumers were spending as their share. For example,
farms were there; they were producing the food, but not getting a just return on it.
Exactly. And so, what we did is, in manufacturing and big business that needed the labor was very happy to receive these people exiting the farms because they were great workers. But we continued with that policy of paying farmers less than their cost of production in the marketplace. Well, that made the big corporations that were buying commodities and selling food very happy. They were able to buy commodities cheaper, the ingredients that made up the food that they sold. And so that made them very happy and very profitable. But what we decided to do then as a society in policy and government policy is to subsidize the farms. Rather than give them a fair share of what consumers spent for food and actually make those corporations be efficient, actually make them have true economies of scale rather than just talking about it, what we did is we decided as a society to subsidize the farmers. And this is where corn can be bad. And this is where Michael Pollan, I think, did a really good job of talking about corn and the Food Inc. and Omnivores Dilemma and Eric Schlosser as well. Is this is where corn becomes bad, is when we subsidize something that isn't good. And for example, we have a wonderful lake ocean of water called the Ogallala Aquifer below the surface of our eastern plains of Colorado and western Kansas. And it goes from south or Scotts Bluff, Nebraska to Lubbock, Texas. And it's an absolute gift to this country. And it's underground water that we put on top of it, center pivot systems, flood irrigated fields, and we have an abundance of water that we can grow food with out there. And we've developed that very, very well. In fact, overdeveloped it. And what we've done is we have grown this corn on that land below the cost of production, pumping a very, very valuable and precious water resource out of the ground and depleting it. We are pumping it out in far greater amounts than the recharge rate. That corn then, based on our government's policy of producing below cost of production, and based upon their trade policies, NAFTA is the one I'm going to refer to, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was between Mexico, United States, and Canada. Based on that, we are shipping corn produced below the cost of production with precious water from the Ogallala Aquifer, requiring massive amounts of fossil fuels to produce. The chemicals used on these crops, including anhydrous ammonia, is made from fossil fuels as well, not manure from livestock. And we ship that corn into Mexico below our cost of production and below Mexico's cost of production. And as a result, we drive more than 1.3 million Mexican families off that land in Mexico. Now, where did they go? Where did those families go? They left the land just like in the United States, and they went into the cities where there was not enough food. There was not enough resources to take care of these people. They lived in the streets. They lived under bridges. They were hungry. Well, there was a bus that came to town. The bus was from an American packing company, and this bus offered them a future in America. And there was people there who lined up the people to get on the bus. And these people went to America to work for our big meat packers. They went to America to work in the fields, picking strawberries and picking tomatoes and all of that. But again, we created, through NAFTA, a cheap workforce to come to America. Now, people say, whoa, that sounds like a conspiracy theory. It's not at all. It's just business. And it's business that made big corporations a lot of money.
Mike, part of my ignorance on this, as I said, I'm a city boy. You talked about all the, this corn, and you called it what, cheap corn?
Absolutely. This corn is produced below cost of production.
It's not a different corn. It just...
Well, in fact, now it's different.
It is?
It's different than it used to be. Corn used to be non-genetically modified.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, yes. Remember the GMOs and all this patenting of life stuff? Our Supreme Court decided on a very 5-4 decision that they would allow the patenting of life. And it opened up a can of worms, essentially, a Pandora's box, really. And as a result, we have a company, Monsanto is the main company, that is now patenting all kinds of forms of life. Thousands of patents are now filed, and they're filing patents on seeds that have been in existence for centuries. And they're going out there and they're finding a seed and they're saying, okay, we're going to patent this seed. And then they go even farther. It's not just the seed that they patent. It's a process where they genetically modify that seed. And it's really all about them gaining the power in the marketplace to control the seed. If you control the seed, you control the agriculture, you control the producer.
How does somebody pick up a seed that's been out there and get a patent on it?
That's the question that we are all asking, and we would love to see the Supreme Court reverse that decision, or Congress to pass laws saying, hey, you can't patent life. God created this life. Man does not have the authority or should not have the permission to patent it. But here's what Monsanto did. They took that seed, corn, and they injected a BT virus into that corn. When a rootworm or an insect eats the corn plant, it kills them. So this is called genetic modification. This is not genetic improvement. This is not plant breeding where we make a better plant that rewards us better for the changes that are made. This is not a plant that grows better in a drought area because it's more tolerant. This is not a plant that is higher in protein. This is a plant that's been genetically modified so that if an insect eats it, it dies. Now, what impact does that have on livestock that eat it? And that's a study that has not been done.
Why do we have something that kills insects? Because we just want to get rid of insects?
Because according to Monsanto, they thought it'd be good to have a plant that killed the insect that preyed upon the plant. And so when you plant corn, we used to use, and still do to some extent, insecticides that are put in the ground with the kernel of corn. So that if the rootworm showed up, which would eat the roots of the corn plant and make it fall over and die, mm-hmm. the rootworm would die. I mean, he would eat the insecticide, would kill him. So Monsanto thought it would be great if we could include a toxin called the BT toxin actually in the genetics of the corn plant.
So you don't have to spray it, you don't have to add it, it's right there.
Exactly, it's right there, and it kills the insect that eats it.
So what does it do to the cattle?
Well, not good. We know that cows that run on a cornfield after the corn is picked, if it's these certain varieties of genetically modified grains, they don't like it. They don't want to eat the corn stalks. And we depend on these corn stalks and these aftermath from crop production to get our cows through the winter because there's no green grass. We run them on cornfields. They can clean up the corn, which is a good thing. You have less volunteer corn coming then in the spring when you plant. It's just a great use of the forage that is out there. But on these many of these genetically modified varieties, the cows will not eat this stuff. They will refuse to eat it. They will starve before they eat it. And so what's the corn itself, the grain that came from that plant, going to do to the livestock? There has been no studies done, and it was never required by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, to have these studies done. In fact, during those deregulation years, during the Reagan administration and the following Bush administration, then the Clinton administration and on into the second Bush administration, we had a dereg mentality in our government. And in fact, the FDA adopted an approval process where a corporation paid $500,000 to the FDA, and with the use of their own in-house studies, many things were approved, including these genetically modified organisms and plants. And so we approved a lot of things that now we are regretting today. We've found many things that shouldn't have been approved that were done on that fast-track basis, and now we're withdrawing many of those from the marketplace.
Mike, was the purpose of that corn from the beginning to feed cattle? Is that what it was being grown for?
The purpose of that corn in the beginning was to give Monsanto a patent that would give them power in the marketplace so they could make more money. That was the purpose of it. And has that ever worked? 90% of the corn and soybean acres in this country today are genetically modified.
But who was it meant for? Isn't it meant for the cattle, the corn?
The corn is absolutely. It's meant for cattle,
and they didn't realize
hogs, and chickens.
But they didn't realize that this was going to be the effect of doing this, that the cattle weren't going to eat it.
They didn't care. The cattle will eat the corn.
Oh.
Now, we don't know that they actually like it, but if you blend it with enough molasses and other things, you can get them to eat it. But we do know from pigs that it causes abscesses and sores in their digestive tract. This corn, in fact, does that. And just in the last month, the Secretary of Agriculture has approved three more GMO varieties. So we've had the approval of alfalfa. We've had the approval of a corn specifically designed for ethanol. You know, how do we know that's going to do well if you feed it to cattle? Or should it be kept separate? It all looks exactly the same when you look at it. And so we've continued to approve more genetically modified varieties without even testing the original ones.
And is this going to have a negative effect on the animals?
Well, I think it does have a negative effect on the animals, but we don't have the science and the studies to do it. In fact, when you sign a Monsanto agreement, when you buy their corn seed or their soy seed, you sign an agreement saying that you will not test. You are banned from testing this product and doing any research on it. Monsanto goes out and they give Kansas State University $1 million. Basically controlling research that's done at that facility. They've gone around and given money to the land-grant universities across our country, including the University of Missouri. They are controlling all of the studies and the research that's being done, and really through contract with farmers and others are blocking any kind of research that might be done that would show that these varieties are harmful.
Mike, we're going to have to take another quick break, so please stay with us, and Mike will get to tell us what we could do about this.
The Colorado Catholic Herald is now on Twitter. The Colorado Catholic Herald, your primary source of news and events from around the diocese, is now on the social media platform of Twitter. Get advance notice of upcoming headlines, breaking news, and special event coverage. Our handle is the @ CCHERALD. That's @CCHERALD. So join us on Twitter.
We're back. I'm speaking today with Mike Calicrate, who has certainly been informing me of an awful lot of things, and hopefully you. This is really not a conversation just about farming, though. I mean, we have Mike here because he believes strongly in the moral significance, the moral overtones of all of this. In essence, putting the small farmer out of business and unable to stand up against the big business of agriculture today. Now, Mike, I got to go back and ask another question, which I'm sure for you is kind of a stupid one, but I'm going to ask it anyway. You talk about these crops that are raised, genetically altered, don't really serve well the animals for whom it's intended. Why is it this counterproductive? Why I don't get this. Why? What's going on here?
Well, it's not counterproductive for Monsanto. It's not counterproductive to the companies who own the patents on these seeds and therefore own the marketplace and are able to extract enormous profits from it, much more than if there was competition, much more than if they weren't able to patent these seeds. And it's not, you know, farmers all the time will tell you that, hey, you don't have to buy their seeds. You know, you don't have to do business with them. We can do business with another company. The problem is, Monsanto is the best example. DuPont would be another company that have simply bought up the competition. They bought out so many of these small seed companies. If you could see the map of what they own and all the dots connected and the names of the companies and so forth, you'd find out very quickly that you really do not have much choice. The other problem that we have in rural America on farms is there are so few people left because of this sort of government policy to move them off the farm for so many years. We're now seeing that was probably a mistake, and we should perhaps reverse that. But the St. Francis, Kansas, for example, where I live, where our cattle operation is, we've lost half the kids in our schools in the last 30 years. We've had a depopulation. The main streets have been nearly abandoned in many of these small towns where the big box stores come in and knock out all the small grocery stores and small shops. And now we're driving 30, 60, 90 miles to a big box store to be able to get what we need. And we talk about how in the world can a farmer live in a food desert? Well, food desert being a place where there's not a lot of food choices available, and particularly healthy food choices. Well, today, farmers are farming much, much larger acreages. And they've been told that that's pretty cool. I mean, you're a big farmer. You should be proud of being a big farmer. Yeah, but at what point does my farm being big become less important than the need of a neighbor? And this is what has happened, is we've lost our neighbors. We've lost the ability to work together. And so farmers now are farming such massive acreages that they have embraced chemical agriculture, which again serves the interests of these big corporations, global corporations, aren't necessarily doing all of their business here. They do it globally. And so they embrace the technologies. They embrace the genetically modified seeds that will let them spray herbicide on their fields that will kill everything but the crop they planted. And this is the genetically modified corn, the genetically modified soybeans. And what's happened is the farmers have been forced to embrace this technology just to be able to get their work done. And oftentimes a farmer will also have a job in town because he can't make enough money. Or he might be fortunate enough, his wife is a school teacher or is providing some additional income to the family. And so he has no time. He's rushed. He hasn't been at the dinner table for a long time to enjoy a meal with his family. He's missed the soccer games as his kids have grown up. And he's just really been forced to work very, very hard. And so he embraces the technology that makes his life easier and his ability to farm the larger acreages. And so when Monsanto develops a variety of corn that you can spray a herbicide on that kills all the weeds except the corn, that's a big deal to that farmer. Now he saves a trip through the field to cultivate the corn. He's obviously paying a lot more for the seed, a lot more money for the seed, which goes into the pockets of the corporations who own the technology and the patents on this stuff. But he's also spending a lot more money on herbicides because he's absolutely spraying this stuff every time.
You say the farmer buys the seed all over again every year.
Yes.
He cannot keep seed for himself, or he cannot produce his own seed that he can replant?
No, he cannot. As part of the agreement that he signs with the company that supplies the GMO technology, whether it's Monsanto, DuPont, or Syngenta, or whoever it may be, he agrees that he will not replant that seed. He has to buy new seed every year. And just to show you how unjust this all gets, there's a case in Canada, Percy Smyser, who was a canola producer, and Monsanto produces a genetically modified canola that you can spray this Roundup herbicide on. Well, seeds from a Monsanto field, not Monsanto owning the field, but a farmer who planted Monsanto seed, pollen from that field, or seeds from a truck harvested from that field that blew off the truck into Percy Smyster's field, were detected by Monsanto investigators. People who go out and look for violators of the agreement that they've signed. And they found this seed, they found this crop in Percy Smyster's field, and they sued him for planting their seeds without a contract and without buying the seed from them, because you cannot replant anything under the contract. You have to buy new seed every year. Now, Monsanto and the farmers' field adjacent to Percy Smyster caused harm to Percy. Percy and his wife had developed these wonderful varieties of canola that are perfectly adapted to the Saskatchewan climate. And they made their money selling pure canola seed. It has just now been contaminated by Monsanto seed. Monsanto sues Percy Smyster for violation of a patent law, and they win. They actually win. He takes it all the way through the Canadian Supreme Court, and they uphold the lower court's decision and award Monsanto the victory in this court.
So he's out of business now?
Well, there's something that has transpired since then that I believe it's been settled. In fact, I know it's been settled, and it's been settled out of court. It's been settled under the guidance of the court, but it was not dictated by the court. It was, and what happened as a result of this grave injustice of Percy Smyster losing his business of producing clean canola, got such worldwide attention that Monsanto's eyes were blackened, and they were shamed as a corporation around the globe for what they had done to this man and his wife in Canada. And so even though Monsanto won, he's still on his farm and he's still farming, but he's lost his seed business. And in fact, Percy Smyster, I first met him at a National Catholic Rural Life Conference. I believe it was in Kansas City, and we were both there on the program.
You mentioned that. I don't even know that we've mentioned the National Rural Life Conference yet, and certainly that is an organization, Catholic organization, that very much espouses the rights of the small farmer, and with you joins in bemoaning the disappearance of the small family farms.
Yes, I guess one of the real reasons that I've become such an advocate for family farms and good food is my friendship with Brother David Andrews. Brother David Andrews was the director of the National Catholic Rural Life Conference for, I believe, 13 years, and that conference has been around more than 80 years altogether, and really, really standing up for farmers and justice in agriculture. And so that's really guided me a lot in my work. And in fact, Brother David and I are on the board of the Organization for Competitive Markets, which is an organization that fights for fair markets and just returns to family farmers and people who, in agriculture. But there's just a lot of history, and I thought about our program today, and I think about the symbolism in the Catholic Church. You know, from the garden, Adam and Eve, and the significance of food, and I look at the table at the Last Supper, and then the bread and the wine, and we talk about transforming water to wine. Do we ever take wine and turn it into water? No, Jesus always improved everything that he touched. But what is Monsanto doing today in this marketplace in agriculture with seeds? Are they improving the corn seed? Heavens no. In fact, they've made it to where you can't even replant it. They've made it to where livestock don't like it. Livestock don't do as well on it. Monsanto has done just the opposite of what we saw in throughout the biblical history of the church, where we improve things. And I think about Afghanistan. I think about the Middle East a lot, because the Middle East is where wheat was really developed, along the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. These people do not need told how to feed themselves. Do you know that in Afghanistan, 85% of the people who live in Afghanistan are on the land? They are out there feeding themselves. They raise goats. They raise gardens. They are self-sufficient, and they live in community. So we go to Iraq, and we destroy their infrastructure. What we decided, what our president, George W. Bush, decided, was that he would send Daniel Amstutz to Iraq to rebuild that agricultural infrastructure. Daniel Amstutz is a former executive of one of the biggest agricultural corporations on our planet. In fact, it's the biggest privately held corporation on our planet in agriculture. It's called Cargill. He went over there and started to implement this sort of American kind of agriculture with Cargill and Monsanto at the very center of it. It's not going well. These people live around food. What is the center of these Middle Eastern communities? The very center. It's the market. It's the food market. They go there every day and they buy food from people that they know. Bread in particular is very important. Fresh baked bread every day. We've lost that in America as we've gone to this industrial type of a food system. And it has not served us well. We now, today, after 50 years of industrializing our food system, losing family farmers, dealing more and depending more on big corporations to produce our food and to further process our food, we now have the highest rates of obesity, heart disease, sugar diabetes, and cancer ever in the history of our country. And we are the second most obese country on the planet and one of the very most unhealthy populations on the planet today, depending more and more on these expensive healthcare system and all the drugs that go with it. And so if we could just learn a lesson from the people of Iraq, of Afghanistan, of the Middle East, about the importance of good food and knowing where it comes from, I think we could learn a lot from them. And then perhaps get along even a little bit better with them, understanding their culture and its honor to about food and in particular the people who produce that food, deserving a just wage.
Mike, before we continue, we're going to need to take another break and we'll be back to continue our conversation.
Hi, this is Bill Howard, editor of the Colorado Catholic Herald. Let the Catholic community know what's happening at your parish. Email information with a point of contact for upcoming events for a free listing in the diocesan calendar in the Colorado Catholic Herald. Send it to us at least 1 month ahead of the event to marie@coloradocatholicherald.com. That's Marie, M-A-R-I-E, @coloradocatholicherald.com. And now we return to a very special episode of Bishop Sheridan Presents.
We're back now with Mike Calicrate, who has been painting a rather bleak picture for us of what's going on in our country and even beyond our country now. Concerning not only the plight of the small family farmer, but the results of what's been going on, not only with our food, but obviously then with us too. It's having effects here. And I know there's a lot more, Mike, to be said. I've learned a lot. But in the few minutes that we do have left, I'm looking at Mike's shirt here. It says Ranch Foods Direct. Now, we know that somehow Mike is not part of this very dark picture. So, and I think wants to talk about how we might turn things around. So back to you.
Well, Bishop, I told you the Catholic Church has had a lot to do with my views on agriculture and social justice. And I think back, one of the statements that moved me was St. Paul, who was an advocate for the farmer. And his quote is, "The hardworking farmer ought to have the first share of the crop." He's also been known to say that the husbandman should be the first partaker of the fruit. And that is absolutely not what is happening today. The husbandman is getting the crumbs, the leftovers, and that's not enough to sustain them. The other thing that I wanted to mention is Thomas Merton, a Trappist monk, lived from 1915 to 1968. He lived in Kentucky, and he said this, "From the moment you put a piece of bread in your mouth, you are part of the world. Who grew the wheat? Who made the bread? Where did it come from? You are in relationship with all who brought it to the table. We are least separate and most in common when we eat and drink." Thomas Merton. What would happen if we could gather again around our family dinner tables and have good food that is good for us? Have a conversation about where the food came from. Perhaps some of it came from our backyard. Perhaps some of it came from just down the road in Pueblo, from the Arkansas Valley Organic Growers Group. Maybe we bought a CSA from them this year, and we're surprised each week with all of the vegetables and the fruits and different things that are coming in that box as this harvest progresses. It's exciting to think about the food that we can prepare and the new recipes we can learn and the new skills of cooking that can occur. And think about this food being completely free of chemicals.
Well, given the situation you've described, how's this going to happen?
Well, it is happening right now, and this is the solution I have fun talking about and being involved in. And I told you I went through a sort of a an epiphany back in the late 80s, 1980s and early 1990s when I came up against the big meat packers. In fact, sued one of them, IBP, the biggest one in the world at the time, sued them for anti-competitive practices. And I just realized that what I was doing in this feedlot in St. Francis, Kansas, applying all of these technologies, trying to be the most efficient operator, applying all the economies of scale that I could possibly think of, was really just wrong. And that there were so many more things that were important, like the healthfulness of animals, the humane treatment of animals, the good food being produced so people can eat well and be healthy, the community that's developed around food production that is gone without good markets, fair markets that fairly reward people. And so I started Ranch Foods Direct after I got essentially blackballed by the big four packers. I had no choice. I got out of the business. I had totally closed down my operation. And so I waited about a year, and I started over again with this whole new approach. And it was really based heavily upon the fact that there's a small packer here in Colorado Springs by the name of GNC Packing Company, a really nice small little packer that does a good job. They run their chains slow. They treat their workers well. And I came to them, and I said, would you slaughter my cattle? Would you kill my cattle so I can sell meat? And they said, absolutely, we'd love to. And so we started business with Ranch Foods Direct here in the spring of 2000, and we've been in business ever since. And I think the real key to it's fine to go after anti-competitive practices and big corporations that we think are behaving badly, but I think we have to have the alternative. We have to work at the alternative. And that being this food system that's local, regional, and that people can actually know their farmer and know where their food comes from. And if you, I've got a website. It's called MikeCalicrate.com, and it's a much more expansive website than Ranch Foods Direct, which is you can find from that website. But there's a lot of stuff on there, neat stuff. One of the links that you'll find on that website is a mobile meat processing site where we talk about rebuilding that infrastructure for small communities to be able to slaughter the livestock, process the livestock, and be able to feed themselves from their own communities. We're not going to eliminate this global food system that's gone around and done business in various countries searching for the cheapest stuff they can find to sell in the highest consuming markets. We're not going to change that overnight, but it would be nice to have a good, healthy alternative that served the communities and served the people well. And so we're talking about change. We need some change in the eater's mentality. And what we've done, I think, in the last 40 years or so is we've become pretty darn aggressive shoppers. It's all about the price. And the whole marketing buzz that's out there all the time and all the media that we are susceptible to talks about us being a good shopper, not a good steward. Not a lot of other things that I think are more important than being a good shopper, but you just got to be this low price shopper. And so Pope John Paul, I thought, made a point, a very good point. Pope John Paul II, a great deal of educational and cultural work is urgently needed, including the education of consumers in the responsible use of their power of choice. I am referring to the fact that even the decision to invest in one place rather than another, in one productive sector rather than another, is always a moral and cultural choice. So where does your food come from? Does that food come to your table from a family farmer that's fairly compensated, that is treating his animals with dignity and respect and humane practices while fertilizing the soil and rebuilding its ability to produce? Or is it coming from a big corporation, a global corporation, who searches the world for the hungriest people that will work the cheapest, applying all of the technology, all of the economies of scale, so-called, to that production? How much human suffering comes with your food? It's our responsibility, I believe, as consumers, to look deeper. And as Pope John Paul II said, make choices that are in our best interests, not only for our families and ourselves, but for the communities and the country that we live in.
But I mean, at this particular moment, do we have that many choices, Mike? The way you've talked about what's out there, you're the real exception, aren't you?
We have very few choices.
Yeah.
We have had a huge increase in farmers markets across the entire country, but there's very, very few choices of where you can get animals processed. And animals are critical to farming. The combination of livestock and crop agriculture is critical because the manure is so valuable for the land. And the cattle and the animals eat the crops. And meat is produced. And so we've got very few choices. But Ranch Foods is a choice for our community here in Colorado Springs. And we facilitate others as well. We've got 40 people that we cut meat for, from Lassiter Grassland Beef to Ray Tiemann's Buffalo to Maytag Ranch up near Westcliff to many others that we cut for, and we'll put their private label on their product. So I am only one of the customers at Ranch Foods Direct. I own the business, but I am there to serve the community. I'm there to serve others and connecting them to consumers as well. We need to replicate the Ranch Foods Direct type model, not that I would have any interest whatsoever, but I would like to see it replicated across the country.
Well, I was going to ask you, are there other operations like this in other parts of the country?
I honestly don't know of any like Ranch Foods Direct. Ranch Foods I not only produce the cattle that is sold at Ranch Foods Direct in our many restaurants that are in the community in the region, but I cut them up. I've got a retail store. We've got a mail order business. We've got a lot that's connected to it. Now, we've got locker plants around the country. Many of them have gone out of business because of abusive and onerous regulations that have been forced upon them by some of our government agencies. But these are the kind of barriers that we have to remove and encourage the rebuilding of this food system. We've got a Secretary of Agriculture right now that has got a program called Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food. Very exciting. We just need to make sure that the tools are made available to others around the country to do the kind of things that Ranch Foods Direct is doing.
You think we can restore the family farm?
We absolutely can if consumers will support it. It's like I've always said, What we feed grows. What we support prospers. If you want food from people you know, all you have to do is buy it from them, and you will have that source grow in your community and become more available.
Can our listeners who are very interested in what you're saying, and I hope all of them are, you said they can go to your website and find out exactly where they could get these foods?
Absolutely. You can go to MikeCalicrate.com.
Calicrate, spell that for them.
C-A-L-L-I-C-R-A-T-E. That's the same Calicrate that was the architect of the Parthenon that I see on the wall here. The John Paul II is at the Parthenon in Greece in this picture. That's the same Calicrate. So, not that I'm related, but the name is the same. There's not many Calicrates around. But if you go to MikeCalicrate.com, you can go to Ranch Foods Direct. You can learn about Calicrate beef, how it's produced. You can learn about Wagyu, which is the Japanese Kobe breed that we breed to the Angus cows to get this high-quality meat. And so there's a blog there as well. So,
well, what can we, what can we ordinary non-farming citizens do just to help turn the situation around, to help the small family farmer rise up again?
Well, I think you become a little bit more involved in the politics, because this is really about policy. If we can establish policy that promotes family farming, healthy food, and community again, we're going to make a lot of progress. Think about the city council votes that were cast yesterday, the mayoral vote that was cast yesterday. Think about the legislators that we've elected in the last cycle. A lot more of them are talking about community today. How do we go back to community? And much of what's happened in this corporate sort of control globalization model has not been good. And if we can get back to community, it's a very hopeful place, and we can actually do something to help ourselves in community, helping one another.
I'm glad we could end on a somewhat positive note. This has been very interesting to me, and I hope to all of our listeners. It's clear that you not only know what you're talking about, you feel deeply about this, and you ground what you're saying in Catholic social teaching, and that's important for all of us. So, Mike, thank you for being with us today, and I think we just really have time to offer our listeners a final blessing. So may the blessing of Almighty God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit come upon all of you and stay with you forever. Amen.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to Bishop Sheridan Presents on the Catholic Radio Network. Join us each week as Bishop Michael Sheridan of the Diocese of Colorado Springs discusses topics relevant to your life and your faith. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a production of the Catholic Radio Network and the Diocese of Colorado Springs. If there is a topic that you'd like to hear covered by Bishop Sheridan Presents, please call the Catholic Radio Network at 970-669-8000. Thanks again for listening to Bishop Sheridan Presents, brought to you by the Colorado Catholic Herald, the official newspaper of the Diocese of Colorado Springs. The Colorado Catholic Herald's blog offers a chance for you to be heard on Catholic issues. Click on the red blog link at coloradocatholicherald.com and join the discussion. The Colorado Catholic Herald, bringing the Catholic world to you.